and through the monomaniacal reference of all the problems of the world to some few biological experiments. On the other side, the misconception of a self-sufficient science independent of history appears through the pseudo-scientific dress of his barbarous errors in religion and practice. Only in the decline of the contemporary epoch has it become the typical behavior of scholars for a person to develop high critical faculties in a specific branch of science while remaining on the level of backward groups in respect to questions of social life and echoing the most ignorant phrases. In the beginning of the bourgeois order, the turn to specific juristic and scientific studies without regard to social and religious demands immediately produced a moment of liberation from the theological tutelage of thought. But as a result of the alteration of the social structure, this sort of production without regard to the rational relation to the whole has become regressive and obstructive in all fields, in science, just as in industry and agriculture. This abstractness and ostensibly interdependence of the bourgeois science industry shows itself in the mass of isolated individual empirical studies not related to any sort of theory and practice by clear terminology and subject matter. It is likewise visible in the efforts of scientists without any significant reason to divest their concepts of all empirical material and especially in the coordinate mathematization of many intellectual disciplines. The conventional attitude of the scholar to the dominant questions of the period and the confinement of his critical attention to his professional speciality were formerly factors in the improvement of the general situation. Thinkers cease to be concerned exclusively with the welfare of their immortal souls or to make concern for it their guide in all theoretical matters. But subsequently, this attitude has taken on another meaning. Instead of being a sign of necessary courage and independence, the withdrawal of intellectual energies from general cultural and social questions, the placing of actual historical interests and struggles in a parenthesis, is more a sign of anxiety and incapacity for rational activity than of an inclination to the true mask of science. The substance underlying intellectual phenomena changes with the social totality. Page 412. It is not the intention here to go into detail in regard to the historical causes of this dual relationship to truth. The competition with the bourgeois economy in the context of which the forces of this society unfolded produced a critical spirit which not only was able to liberate itself from the bureaucracies of church and absolutism, but driven by the dynamic of the economic apparatus can to a fantastic degree place nature at its service. But this power only seems to be its own. The methods for the production of social wealth are available. The conditions for the production of useful natural effects are largely known, and the human will can bring them about. But this spirit and will themselves exist in false and distorted form. The concept of having power over something includes deciding for oneself and making use of it for one's own purposes. But domination over nature is not exercised according to a unified plan and purpose, but merely serves as an instrument for individuals, groups, and nations, which use it in their struggle against one another and as they develop it. at the same time reciprocally circumscribed and bended to destructive ends. Thus, the bearer of this spirit, with their critically capacity and their developed thinking, do not really become masters, but are driven by the changing constellations of the general struggle, which even so summoned up by men themselves, face them as incalculable forces of destiny. This seemingly necessary dependence, which increasingly bears fruit in disruptive tensions and crises, general misery and decline, become for the greatest part of mankind an incomprehensible fate. But to the extent that the alteration of basic relationships is excluded in practice, a need arises for an interpretation based purely on faith. The conviction that a constricting and painful constellation is essentially unalterable prods the mind to give it a profound interpretation so as to be able to come to terms with it without despairing. Death as the inevitable end was always the basis of the religious and metaphysical illusion. The metaphysical need which permeates the history of this period stems from the fact that the inner mechanism of this society, which produces insecurity and continuous pressure, does not emerge into clear consciousness and is put up with as something necessary and eternal, rather than as an object of effective change. The firm faith, which was part of the model of the medieval social structure, has disappeared. The great systems of European philosophy were always intended only for an educated upper crust and failed completely in the face of the psychic needs of the impoverished and socially continually sinking sections of the citizenry and peasantry, who are nevertheless completely tied to this form of society by upbringing, work, and hope, and cannot believe it to be transitory. Page 413. This is why the intellectual situation has for decades been dominated by the craving to bring an internal meaning into a life which offers no way out, by philosophical practices such as the direct intellectual or intuitive apprehension of truth, and finally by blind submission to a personality, be it anthroposophic, prophet, a poet, or a politician. To the extent to which individual activity is circumscribed and a capacity for it eventually stunted, there exists the readiness to find security and the protective shelter of a faith or person taken as the vessel, an incarnation of the truth. In particular periods of the rise of contemporary society, the expectation of steady progress within its own framework reduced the need for an interpretation that would transfigure reality, and the rational and critical faculties achieved greater influence in private and public thought. But as this form of social organization becomes increasingly crisis-prone and insecure, all those who regard its characteristics as eternal are sacrificed to the institutions which are extended as substitutes for the lost religion. This is, to be sure, only one aspect of the social situation out of which the shaky relationship to truth in modern time arises. A fundamental analysis of the fallacious bourgeois self-perception, which preserves the ideology of complete inner freedom in the face of the dependence and insecurity of its bearers, could show that the liberal validation of alien ideas, the mark of relativism, has a common root with the fear of making one's own decision, which leads to belief in a rigid absolute truth, the abstract, reified concept of the individual, which inescapably dominates thought in this economic system. But here the question is less one of the derivation of the phenomenon than of its practical significance. Is there really only the choice between acceptance of the final truths as proclaimed in religions and idealistic schools of philosophy, and the view that every thesis and every theory is always merely subjective, that is, true and valid for a person or a group or a time or mankind as a species, but lacking objective validity? In developing the dialectical method, bourgeois thought itself has made the most ambitious attempt to transcend this antinomy. Here, the goal of philosophy no longer appears, as in Kant, to be merely the system of the subjective factors of cognition. Perceived truth is no longer so empty that in practice one must take refuge in the solidity of faith, while the concrete content is perceived as a conditional and dependent, and every final truth is just as decisively negated as in Kant, it does not, for Hegel, simply fall through the sieve in the sifting out of pure knowledge. Page 414. Recognition of the conditional character of every isolated view and rejection of its absolute claim to truth does not destroy this conditional knowledge. Rather, it is incorporated into the system of truth at any given time as a conditional, one-sided, and isolated view. Through nothing but the continuous delimitation and correction of partial truth, the process itself evolves its proper content as knowledge of limited insight in their limits and connections. To skepticism, Hegel opposes the concept of determinate negation. The progressive recognition of partial truth, the advance from one isolated definition to another, means for him not a mere lining up of attributes, but a description which follows the actual subject matter in all particulars. This critique of every concept and every complex of concepts by progressive incorporations into the more complete picture of the whole does not eliminate the individual aspects, nor does it leave them undistributed in subsequent thought, but every negated insight is preserved as a moment of truth in the progress of cognition, forms a determining factor in it, and is further defined and transformed with every new step. Precisely because of this, the methodological form of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis is not to be applied as a lifeless diagram. Footnote 8, text. If at any given time the antithesis expresses the critical and relativizing impetus in opposition to the assimilation and establishment of a pattern of thought, thesis and antithesis together immediately form a new insight. A synthesis, because the negation has not simply rejected the original insight but has deepened and defined it. Hegel does not end up with the bare assurance that all definite knowledge is transitory and unreal, that what we know is only appearance in contrast to an unknowledgeable thing in itself or an intuitively perceived essence. If, for Hegel, the truth is the whole is not something distinct from the parts of its determinate structure, but the entire pattern of thought, which at a given time embraces in itself all limited conceptions in the consciousness of their limitations. Since the dialectical method does not rest with showing that a thing is conditioned but takes the conditioned thing seriously, it escapes the relativistic formalism of the Kantian philosophy. Hegel, therefore, does not need to make a fetish out of an isolated concept like that unduly. He recognizes the vain effort of all idealistic philosophy before him to make the whole content of the world disappear in some conceptual generalization and declare all specific